Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Peabody versus Davis. Counsel, will you give me the pronunciation of your name?
Verdelia.
Mr. Verdelia, you're up.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. I'm George Verdelia. I represent Andrew Davis, Robin Cole, and the plan. I will be arguing on behalf of all appellants. The trial court in this case gave Mr. Peabody a $500,000 windfall. There is no evidence or law to support the judgment of the trial court. It should be reversed, and judgment should be entered for the defendants. There were two important rulings that the district court made that require reversal. The first, and the two are, one, that the district court found that there was no ERISA violation in the initial rollover transaction that started this process back in 1999. The second important ruling was that the trial court find that there was no shareholder agreement requiring the purchase and sale of the stock held for Mr. Peabody's benefit in the plan account. And I might refer shorthand as Mr. Peabody's stock, but with the understanding that that was how it was owned. First, as to the initial transaction, the rollover transaction, Mr. Peabody continues to comment in his briefs that that transaction gave Rock Island Corporation substantial cash. It did not net give Rock Island Corporation a penny. Mr. Peabody did not pay net a penny for that stock. He wasn't supposed to. It was a discretionary bonus. It was a gift. But Mr. Peabody did not want to take his one-third of his bonus as stock. He wanted cash. That wasn't the way the bonus was offered, but that's what Mr. Peabody wanted. Mr. Peabody suggested this rollover transaction by which the net effect was he would receive cash equivalent to the amount of stock as an additional bonus, and the stock would be purchased and held in his plan account. So the transaction was cash neutral as to the corporation. Whatever money it got in for the stock, it paid right out again to Mr. Peabody in his bonus. The only one who benefited from this transaction was Mr. Peabody, because he cashed out the retirement account he held.
Well, let's talk about the management of the money, not how it got started. I don't know how relevant that is.
Well, it's relevant because the trial court found that there was no violation of ERISA in doing this rollover transaction. So the stock that he had in his account was not his retirement savings. He had no basis in that stock. He didn't pay a penny for that stock. It was simply his way that he requested the stock be held in order to allow him to get more money out in cash.
Well, the stock had value after he received it, and he received it, didn't he?
He certainly did, Your Honor. He certainly did. But the fact that the rollover transaction was held to be not a violation of ERISA means that from that point forward, there must be some other point in time at which the court is entitled to find that there was some violation in continuing to hold the stock.
Why didn't they diversify the holdings? That, I think, is the heart of the case.
They didn't diversify because, as the trial...
They had 98% of it in a worthless stock. I mean, that should tell you
They didn't diversify it, Your Honor, because Mr. Peabody did not want it diversified. He wanted the stock held in the plan. That's what it was his suggestion. It was his idea.
Well, I think he suggested they get it initially, but he didn't tell them to keep holding it exclusively for the rest of the time, did he?
Well, actually, Judge, he's never said anything one way or the other about it. He certainly did not tell them to diversify. He certainly did not tell them to sell
stuff. Well, that's a standard thing for trustees to diversify.
It would be if this were his investment, retirement investment, but it was not. It was his discretionary bonus stock. It was a gift to him, and he wanted it held that way.
Well, you diversify because you don't want to have your risk exclusively in one place. You don't know what's going to go up and what's going to go down, but you want to diversify so that you have some hedge against losses. And I think that's pretty universal, isn't it? I don't know why you should be exempted from the diversification requirement.
I don't see it as an exemption from the requirement. I see it as this was what Mr. Peabody requested, and if in fact there was a duty to diversify, then the trial court would have been required to find that duty arose immediately upon the transaction. They would have been in violation of it from day one.
Well, maybe they were. I don't know.
Not only did Mr. Peabody agree with the purchase and placement in the savings plan, it was his idea. Once you have that decision, with the original purpose being to give Mr. Peabody stock as a gift, as a bonus, Mr. Peabody never told the trustees to sell the stock, and there is no evidence, expert or otherwise, that there was any particular point in time at which a reasonable person would say they should have sold the stock on this date and this would have been the result in terms of diversification. There is no evidence in the record as to any particular point in time, primarily because there was no expert testimony, as to when the duty arose, if at all, to sell that stock and diversify. There simply was no evidence in the record. Now, the other important ruling that the court made was that there was no shareholder agreement. That means there was no obligation to buy or sell shares, the shares that were held for Mr. Peabody's benefit. Mr. Peabody was entitled to receive his plan benefit, which included distributing the shares to him had the trustees so chosen in 2004. Mr. Peabody didn't want the stock. So he and Mr. Davis entered into an agreement. The trial court said that the trustees were obligated in 2004 to pay fair market value for the stock. There is no evidence in the record that they were obligated to buy the stock at all, far less pay fair market value. And there is no evidence in the record that fair market value, of the fair market value as of 2004. The trial court went back to 2001 when there was a small purchase of stock. The trial court deemed that to be fair market value without any evidence in the record that it was fair market value. It was an isolated transaction involving an insider at the time. And so there is no evidence that that was fair market value. But even if you can conclude that that was fair market value in April 2001, there is absolutely no basis in the record for concluding that that fair market value was the same, was at the same level in January of 2004. Calculating fair market value, as we've seen in the case law.
Well, I thought you just told us that you couldn't tell when this duty arose, what point in time it arose. So what's sacred about 2004 as opposed to 2001?
Oh, there's nothing sacred about it, Your Honor. But 2004 was the trial court's view of when they were obligated to buy the stock back because he was terminated, his employment was terminated. That's what the trial court said, was that's the time that they were obligated to buy it back. But the trial court didn't have evidence of fair market value in 2004, so it went back to 2001 and without any support said, we're going to use this 2001 figure for the 2004 fair market valuation.
Isn't that part of the real problem here is that it's very difficult to determine damages because of the way a stock was valued or how it came up? There was no expert testimony with regard to...
There was none. Plaintiff had tendered a purported expert disclosure which did not comply with the rules and it was stricken and his experts were barred. Yes, Your Honor. In conclusion, the trial court reached far outside the bounds of the evidence and the law and manufactured a figure that provided Mr. Peabody with in excess of $500,000 for stock, all but five shares of which he never paid a penny for.
Well, the bottom line, though, is that Mr. Peabody ended up with a worthless benefit in the plan. because this company went bankrupt and the stock became worthless. I don't know about the details of the calculation, but that suggests some errors on the part of the trustees, doesn't it?
It doesn't suggest any error when they were told by Mr. Peabody to hold his stock in the plan.
Trustees are doing a good job. Their assets don't go to zero, do they?
Trustees can't guarantee assets don't go to zero, Your Honor. They can't guarantee that.
No, but they can diversify. As I understand it, the other beneficiaries of this plan had a lot of other assets. They had stock funds and so forth, other than the stock of this company. And Mr. Peabody is unhappy because his share went to zero and nobody did anything about it.
Some of the other participants had other assets besides stock in the plan. That was what they requested, and that's what they got. And the other problem with finding that the trustees had a duty to diversify is that there is no evidence, not only no evidence of when that duty arose, but also no evidence of what could have or should have happened with the diversification. What else should they have bought? Where else should the money?
It arose when they got the stock in the first place.
The trial court ruled that that was not the case, Your Honor. The trial court ruled that there's no duty to diversify.
The trial court could conceivably not be correct in that determination.
That's true. That was not appealed by the plaintiff, and I'm not quite sure how you would go about unwinding that transaction, because if you were going to rescind the entire transaction, you would have to not only give Mr. Peabody his retirement account back, he would have to return his bonus that he got as a result of the transaction. So he hasn't sought that form of relief, or hasn't appealed that decision with the trial court.
Thank you, Mr. Rodelia. Mr. Polk?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Lee Polk, and I represent Plaintiff Peabody. In this ERISA case, we come to the court after a three-day bench trial in July of 07, and the plaintiff seeks affirmance of the basic ruling of the court that the trustees breached their fiduciary duties under ERISA. But we also approach the court requesting the court's favorable consideration of some adjustments in the relief that the trial court granted. We also request the court to consider the district court's ruling on the fidelity bond, which is a big issue in this case. Before getting into the substance, I'd like to raise a point that I contacted the clerk's office midweek last week to identify myself for oral argument and requested a 3-minute allocation of my time for rebuttal, which I thought was consistent with the briefing pattern, but I was told that it would have to be a written motion to for me as cross appellant to move some of my time to rebuttal. If the court would entertain an oral motion right now, I'd like 3 minutes for rebuttal. If not, that's okay too. It's not the end of the world, but I would like to.
All right, you may have the 3 minutes.
Thank you, Judge. The first major issue here is one of fiduciary breach. The trustee's basic job, whether it's ERISA or common law, is to protect the assets of the trust. In this basic job, our trustee defendants in this case failed miserably. They had extensive loyalties to their company and indirectly themselves because they own the company and control the company as well as controlling the plan. And they were disloyal to Peabody, the participant, in so doing. The liability that the court found was based on 29 U.S.C. 1104A1, ERISA 404A1, and 1106, which is the prohibited transaction issues. Prohibited transactions are per se violations of ERISA fiduciary duties. The 404A1.
Well, that rule is intended to preclude insider transactions, right?
Not only insiders, but any party in interest who receives plan assets in a prohibited transaction under...
But I don't see what Mr. Peabody lost. He got a worthless loan instead of worthless stock. So
that was it.
How is he affected by that?
Well, our position is that it was not worthless stock because everyone had a duty, Judge, to follow the ERISA statute, and 404A1D says you follow the terms of the plan. The terms of the plan, and this gets into the amount of the plan's loss, which is what you referred to as worthless stock. And I was just about to move to that point anyway. The district judge picked $500 a share based on a 2001 transaction that Mr. Verdelli just commented on. But the terms of the plan required the trustees to value the stock each year as of December 31st. That's explicit in the terms of the plan. ERISA requires everybody to follow the terms of the plan. The trustees, in their best judgment, issued benefit statements identifying that stock as valued in 2001, 2002, December 31, at $625 a share. In 2003, 30 days before they fired Peabody, it was valued at $550 a share. So our position is that the district judge had an obligation to follow 404A1D, which says everybody should follow the terms of the plan. And the plan clearly said the trustees have to value the stock. Lord knows a rank-and-file employee or even a management employee of Rock Island like Peabody, I had no wherewithal to be able to value the stock. The only people who knew about the company's financial fortunes were the two trustees who owned the company. They were the only people that could value the stock. And they came out annually with benefit statements, $625 a share, $625 a share. Then, 2003, it went down to $550 a share. At trial, one of the trustees testified that she saw, the CFO, she saw financial storm clouds on the horizon for Rock Island around 2002. Well, right then and there, any good faith fiduciary of that trust should have reversed that transaction and caused the company to repurchase that Rock Island stock then.
Just because the stock declines in value doesn't mean you immediately have to sell it.
I've
never heard of a rule like that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But more, don't you?
That's correct, Your Honor. But in this case, they wrote it all the way down in flames till it crashed.
I think there's a duty to diversify to your risk. And I believe that's one of your claims on this appeal.
That's correct. Oh, and that's consistent with what I'm saying. That's consistent. They should have reversed the stock transaction. They had the wherewithal to move the money, the cash to the company.
But
they controlled.
I don't know if there's any obligation to sell it all at X point in time. I mean, that's...
Well, not at X point in time, but certainly before it went to zero.
Legal obligation to impose on trustees, I think.
Well, they had an obligation to do the best job they could for their beneficiary, and they did not do that here. And so whether you consider the court's ruling on the plan's loss at $417,000 based on $500 a share or $521,000 $875 based on $625 a share, 2001, 2002 numbers, or $459,000 a share for the total shares at $550 a share, which was their own number. At trial, they testified, we disseminated these benefit statements to communicate to the participants what the value of your retirement benefit is. That was the whole point of the benefit statements. And now they're disclaiming and trying to disassociate themselves from their own handiwork, and that is totally unacceptable for good faith trustees.
Are you saying that because that was the reported value, that is conclusively establishes that the correct value?
I'm saying that.
And not only correct, but an appropriate value for this purpose.
I am saying that, Your Honor, based on this court's precedent, the Eiler case, precedents from other jurisdictions like Henry versus Champlain, they're all abundantly clear that the burden rests with the trustees to set the value of the trust assets. Who else would be in a position to do that? No one. And so we are taking that position, and it's, in my view, I would argue that it's a rock-solid position because there's nobody else other than the trustees who, in this case, controlled a closely held corporation. It's not a publicly held corporation, which has New York Stock Exchange purchases and sales. They're the only ones who would know, and they controlled both the companies and the trust in this case. I wanted to turn with one sentence to a part of our case, which is RIC. The trial judge determined that it was not to be held liable for a prohibited transaction, which we certainly have here in the evidence, based on the fact that the trial court found that RIC was not a fiduciary. Our count 20 clearly stated that RIC was a party in interest. The Supreme Court's precedent in Harris Trust case, which came from the Seventh Circuit, by the way, but the Supreme Court's decision in Harris Trust clearly made a party in interest who receives plan assets for no consideration to be subject to prohibited transaction rules and equitable relief such as constructive trust and the like. So it's our position that RIC should have been found liable along with the trustees and RIS as who were deemed to be fiduciaries. I'm turning now to the issue of count 22 in our complaint, which was an ordinary benefit claim. The statutory scheme work in our case is such that 502A2, which is the breach of fiduciary duty claim, 1102A2 and 1109, which is are two tandem provisions intended to restore the plan's loss. Those were what we were talking about a moment ago about the fiduciary breach and the loss of $500,000 roughly to the plan based on the trustees' own valuations. That statutory structure is intended for a judgment such as the district judge's ruling in this case to restore to the plan the plan's losses. That's 502A2 of ERISA. 502A1B is the ordinary benefit claims that we see much more of in the district courts, and that's count 22 of Peabody's complaint. Peabody looks to the court, and as a matter of fact, Your Honors, when Peabody originally...
This is just a backup claim, isn't it?
No, it's not.
If you got damages, what do you need with a benefit? I mean, you're not going to get double damage.
No, it's central to this case, Your Honor, in this sense. Peabody needs to have...
I think that claim is there because if you don't get the damages, then you ought to get the benefit. Why it's relevant now that you got the damage.
It is relevant in this sense, Your Honor. The statutory scheme work, and this is the recent Supreme Court case in LaRue, damages for fiduciary breach should go back to the plan to restore the plan's loss, namely Peabody's account. Then, when his account is restored, 502A1B is an ordinary benefit claim, which is important to this participant, Judge Cudahy, because he needs a plan distribution to be able to roll over a plan distribution with a tax-deferred treatment under the tax laws into an IRA or some other vehicle. If he were to simply get a payment from the judgment debtors in this case, the two trustees, it would not be subject to favorable tax treatment. He would not be on a plane with all of the other plan participants. So it's very important that he get a benefit claim ruled favorably, count 22 of our complaint, and it's inexplicable to me why the district judge below considered this to be moot, because it's far from moot in terms of the realities and the practicalities of a participant receiving a benefit claim. It's very important. I won't belabor
that. I think the judge was just saying he got his money, so he's not entitled to more.
Well, he got money that could not be taxed. He's going to get hit with a tax if he gets a direct payment from the judgment debtors directly to him. If he gets it through the plan, Well, then it's tax. He has the option to make it tax deferred with a rollover to an IRA, as millions of Americans do every year. Now, I wanted to turn to non-monetary relief, if I may. The district judge, for whatever reason, declined to agree to our request that the trustees be removed from office. These parties are at each other's throats and have been for years now, since this case was filed in August of 2005, and we have not had decent treatment from the trustees. Peabody has not had decent treatment from the trustees consistent with their duty of loyalty, which the law presumes and mandates be accorded him. We ask for disclosures of the plan's assets, transactions, and the like that plan participants should normally be allowed to have. Even with loyal fiduciaries, they should be able to know what's going on with their plan. And two formal motions we made to the district court were denied for reasons I'm not quite sure of. But at any rate, for the trustees to remain in office going forward when we're trying to collect on this judgment, there's a structural inherent conflict of interest, and I don't see how they can collect money for themselves, because this is a judgment that's due to the plan, first of all, under 502A2 and the LaRue Supreme Court decision. This is a judgment that should be paid to the plan. So how are the trustees going to collect the money from themselves? Plus, the treatment of Peabody in this matter over the last few years has been subpar in the extreme, and we need to have new trustees that are independent and able to act even-handedly over the trust and its operations. So we asked for removal of the trustees, and that was denied. We asked for disclosures of plan information, assets, and transactions. That's been denied on several occasions.
Polk, when did you seek removal of Davis and Cole?
Well, in the complaint, that's one of the requests in the complaint. I believe we had a post-judgment motion that was filed in late September 2005. We asked for five elements of relief, and I believe that was one of them there.
You have a motion filed on the 17th of August of 2009, which was denied 2 days later.
Correct. That's
is there a motion filed prior to that?
We had an earlier motion for disclosure of plan information, yes.
I mean, I'm speaking specifically to the issue of removal.
Removal of trustees. I don't know that we had a motion before that, because we were waiting for the, up until September, if you think about the calendar, the case was tried in July 2007, then there were over 2 years of downtime. We didn't know if we prevailed or didn't prevail. So September came, September 2009 came, and the judge issued his ruling on September 2nd, 2009, and then we had a post-judgment motion at the end of September 2009, which we had five elements of non-monetary relief, and I believe it was in there that we asked again for removal consistent with our complaint and consistent with the trial. So at any rate, those are the elements of non-monetary relief that we sought. And we also, as the third element, besides removal and disclosures, we asked for the trial court to retain jurisdiction over the case, because these trustees have been found by a federal district judge to have breached their fiduciary duties with no oversight, no supervision, nothing like that. And we simply wanted to have somebody in authority, like the district judge, to maintain some degree of oversight and supervision. For whatever reasons, the district judge did not grant that request either.
He denied it without any comment. And other than the reference to Cardozo's morals of the marketplace, Mr. Polk, which, of course, it's hard to quarrel with, was any authority presented to him in that motion?
For retention of jurisdiction. I can tell you, Your Honor, just based on experience as a practitioner, that it's frequently accomplished. I quoted from the Free versus Bridie case in the 80s in my brief, and at that time, Judge Hart retained jurisdiction in a very similar case to this, where this court finally got to the point of characterizing the conduct of the judgment debtor trustees as a mockery when it came to collecting on the judgment because assets were very difficult to find. But at any rate...
Well, I'm having some difficulty, and maybe it's just my research, in finding the orders that you're appealing from. They're not appended, are they, to any pleadings and
the order
on this interlocutory ruling on this question of the removal of the trustees. Perhaps I just need a further search.
Well, Your Honor,
I just wonder whether we got jurisdiction on this issue
for removal. Now, are we talking about
the?
Well, we've asked it in the complaint. And I believe our post-judgment motion asked for it. That's as good as I can. My memory will take me right now.
Thanks.
Now, with the time remaining, I wanted to turn to a very important question, and that is the fidelity bond in this case. The bond issue.
Well, the first question there is, what is the dishonesty in this case that would invoke the bond in the first place? I don't see any evidence of dishonesty.
Well, Your Honor, we have to look at what is the definition of dishonesty for purposes of fidelity bonds. And it is clear in the law that dishonesty is not so serious as to be criminal dishonesty. It's less than criminal dishonesty.
Well,
the Department of Labor, the Department of Labor regulations refer to it as including wrongful conversion, wrongful misappropriation, and similar types of conduct. The leading Illinois case from 1963, which we quoted in our papers, I think it's called Home Indemnity versus Reynolds. Talks about willful and wanton disregard. And we have all of that in this case. These trustees were interested in maintaining the welfare of their company, not their fiduciary. And when it came time to, when the tire met the road, we can ask, what did the trustees do that was so dishonest and so claimable under this fidelity bond? They did a number of things with respect to Peabody, aside from misrepresentations to the government and annual reports and commingling
money. I don't understand why you want to get at the insurance companies, because they're the only ones that have any money left, apparently. But I'm not sure you got a sound basis for doing so.
Well, look, put yourself in Peabody's shoes for a moment, please. The negotiations that took place at the time of Peabody's termination, we have an employee benefit plan that is supposed to report to the participant what his retirement benefit is that he can count on, and that's part and parcel of the benefit statements that were issued every year, as testified to by the trustees. But when they fired Peabody, Mr. Davis approached Peabody, and he starts negotiating with him about the value of his account. What kind of retirement security is that? We'll give you half of what we told you in the benefit statement this stock was worth if you delay it for a year. What kind of treatment is that when all of the other participants, in accordance with the plan documents, were paid out when they were terminated from employment? Not only did they engage in a horrendous amount of negotiating future values of RIC stock, which is mind-boggling to an observer, but they also were going through phony acts with the loan. The loan wasn't even committed to paper. It was a letter that the trustee sent to Peabody. There was no loan guarantees the way they did in a commercial sense.
How was that stock valued? By either side. How was it valued? What mechanism was used to
value? The judge found correctly that the defendants, trustees, did not carry their burden and present any mechanism or any formula by which the stock was valued. It was whim. And that's part of what the problem was when Peabody was terminated from employment. He was subject to the whim. He was going out the door, had no leverage, and Mr. Davis was the boss of the company as well as the trustee, and whatever Mr. Davis said is what was going to happen. And Peabody understood that. He acquiesced, got the best deal he could, which was less than what the benefit statement said he was entitled to. And so they were going through these mechanisms and this charade about a loan, but in fact what happened was the stock left the plan, went to the company, and at trial, in response to my questions, the trustees indicated that in spring of 2004, when Peabody was fired, the company did have the cash to pay his benefit if they reversed the transaction and sold the stock back to RIC and got cash for it and paid Peabody out in the normal course. It had the cash in spring of 2004. And Trustee Cole also testified that they had the cash in spring of 2005, but they chose to allocate the company's cash to the company's creditors other than Peabody. So the disloyalty was very ripe and dominant in this fact setting. And I better stop if I'm going to want to have my – I really do want to have that rebuttal. So
thank you, Mr. Pope.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Schmokler?
May it please the court, counsel. This is not a case of embezzlement. It's not a case of a trustee acting unilaterally without a plan participant's knowledge and consent. Mr. Peabody knew about every action taken in his plan account, and he consented to it. And the dispute that you heard between Mr. Peabody and the trustee is over violations of ERISA. Well, ultimately, those violations aren't what my clients agreed to insure. My clients, Hanover Insurance Company and Liberty Mutual Surety, issued commercial crime policies. Those policies are not liability policies that insure the trustee's liability. They're not statutory policies that cover every ERISA violation. They're an indemnity policy that covers the plan against a specific risk, employee dishonesty. And the limited discussion that Mr. Polk had in his presentation of the insurance issue really ignores the three fundamental issues in this case. One, Mr. Peabody doesn't have standing to pursue this claim. Two, if he had standing, he didn't pursue the claim timely. And third, there is absolutely no evidence that the trustees acted with the intent to cause the plan a loss. Fundamental to this lawsuit is whether Mr. Peabody has the right in the first instance to even bring this claim against my client. My client issued an indemnity policy to a corporation, the plan. The plan is the sole entity with the right to pursue a claim, the sole entity with any rights. Mr. Peabody, in his individual capacity, has no right to bring this claim, and he doesn't assert any right. Mr. Peabody's sole argument has been that he has the right to pursue a claim on behalf of the plan. That entire concept was rejected by the United States Supreme Court in the Mertens case, which said that a plan participant does not have a right to sue a non-fiduciary for monetary damages. And that is exactly what Mr. Peabody attempts to do. My clients aren't a fiduciary under ERISA, and all that we heard from Mr. Polk this morning was how he was going to get a recovery of money and how he was going to collect against judgment debtors. That is not a right Mr. Peabody has. He has no standing to pursue this claim, and he made no argument this morning to suggest otherwise. However, even if we could get past that first initial hurdle, what we heard this morning is that Mr. Peabody knew exactly what was going on at the time it was going on. The core of his claim, the rollover transaction and this sale. Mr. Peabody was part and parcel of those. He knew about those transactions at the moment they occurred. If they're dishonest, and I don't believe they are, and we're going to get to that in a moment, but if we were to assume, for sake of argument, that we take Mr. Peabody's claim at face value, and that the trustees did something wrong at that time, and that Mr. Peabody now has the right to pursue this claim. He had two obligations. submit a proof of loss to us in 120 days, file suit in 2 years. He did neither. And there is no dispute about that. I asked Mr. Peabody at trial whether or not he knew of the conduct he characterizes as dishonest and whether or not he met his contractual obligations. He said he did not. And that was the alternative holding that the district court reached and which was not appealed by Mr. Peabody in his brief. There was not a single sentence devoted to the timeliness of this claim in Mr. Peabody's brief, and therefore any argument as to timeliness has certainly been waived. The only thing we heard in reply for the first time was something about adverse domination. Adverse domination has never been recognized by Illinois law, and, quite frankly, directly contradicts Mr. Peabody's standing argument. He never explains to the court how, on the one hand, he can have standing, and on the other hand, he could be powerless to act. Those concepts are inconsistent. Either he has no standing, in which case his claim is out, or he has standing, in which case he had to meet the timely obligations under the policy, which he admit he did not do. And then the third point that we raised at the trial is there's just no evidence of dishonesty. Mr. Polk talks about 1963. I'd like to talk about the policy. The policy has a definition of dishonesty. It's conduct perpetrated with the manifest intent to cause the plan a loss and the manifest intent to obtain an improper personal financial gain. There's no evidence of either. In this case, the trustees consulted with Mr. Peabody, and he may want to quibble over whether or not that's a violation of ERISA, and that's certainly his right. But a plan participant that knows about and consents the conduct can't now say that it was dishonest, and it can't now say that it was done with intent to cause a loss. That's the exact concept this court in the Associates versus Home Insurance case characterized as silly. So for the reasons in our brief and in the district court opinion, we ask that the judgment be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Milford. Mr. Verdelia.
Mr. Polk commented on the statements that were prepared for Rock Island Company reflecting what was identified as net asset value. The trial court was very clear in ruling that net asset value was not a meaningful number to use for the fair market value of Mr. Peabody's stock. That net asset value was the appraisal, evaluation, estimate, if you will, of what the per share value of the entire company would be if you sold the entire company. When you value, as the Chow versus Hall case points out, among others, when you value Mr. Peabody's stock, assuming that you're required to conduct a fair market valuation, you must, among other things, apply a minority discount because this is a closely held private company. It is not a publicly traded company. So the net asset value statements Mr. Polk referred to were specifically determined by the court not to apply to the fair market value calculation. Mr. Polk also commented that the trial court found that the trustees did not meet their burden of establishing fair market value. He refers to cases in which the trustees are attempting to defend a transaction they conducted. They took plan assets, invested them in some stock or other instrument, and as a result of that transaction were required to prove that they got adequate consideration. The trustees are not being sued here for a transaction they conducted. They are being sued for failing to do something. And part of plaintiff's claim, if he wants to recover against the trustees, is to establish what the fair market value of was of the benefit that he believes he was to receive. He can't put that burden on us and change normal court procedure because we have no way of knowing when we were supposed to have done this transaction or what the price or valuation of that transaction would have been, to whom we would have sold the stock, and all of the other circumstances. That is why you need testimony. Typically, it's expert testimony as to the duty, the timing, the valuation.
Mr. Verdelia, would it help at all to look to the $350 figure that was used when the loan was structured?
Well,
I mean, that would give us, by my calculation, a $292,000, roughly.
I think the math is correct, Your Honor. The point of that $350 calculation, that was a negotiated price. That is not reflective of all of the circumstances that you have to take into account in doing a fair market valuation of his stock. That was an agreed number. He was first offered a lower dollar per share number to be cashed out immediately in 2004, and he declined that. So I don't think it would be helpful to determine the fair market value in 2004 because that was an agreed upon number to be paid in the future. I don't believe that number is relevant for fair market valuation purposes, not only for that reason, but because it's, as the fair market 5960 says, there's a whole laundry list of evaluations that you have to apply, including it is supposed to be a hypothetical transaction. And this is an actual transaction. It's not clear what all the motivations are for that valuation. So I would suspect that would not be an appropriate valuation for fair market value. Okay. That concludes my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Day.
Thank you.
Mr. Polk. Would your response be the same about that $350 figure, Mr. Polk?
No, Your Honor. Our response is that we follow the plan documents. The plan documents repose the authority on the trustees to set the values of the stock, not whim, not future speculation of if you delay your payment, it's going to...
$500 is not whim. Is that your position?
The $500 is an objective transaction that occurred in 2000.
One single transaction.
For that single transaction in 2001. But that was... lower than the trustees' own valuation of their stock in the benefit statements.
The thing that's questionable, though, is the year, the date at which you make this calculation. I don't know that there's any iron law that it's got to be 2001 or 2004.
I agree with that, and that's the district judge's job to make the best judgment that he can. I agree. It had to be somewhere in that time frame, and the district judge's range of discretion was when did the plan's loss occur, and then everything else follows from there.
You can't say that it occurred at any particular instant in time.
Well, somewhere between 625 and zero. I mean, eventually it became zero, but not before February of 2004 when he terminated and the stock went out of the plan. I'd like to turn to the
I know we've asked you some questions, but of course that's part of the deal. So you may have one more minute.
The insurance companies were not prejudiced by any delays. They participated in the trial. They had an opportunity, and no one in this case has pointed to anyone who would claim on the Fidelity bond other than Peabody. We're almost in a never-never land here by saying he was too late, but who else would have done it? The defendant trustees misled us in Rule 26A1 disclosures by not telling us who the trustees were. Finally, in depositions, I found who the insurer was. Finally, in depositions, I found out who the insurer was, and we brought him into the case within 30 days, practically. So we did everything. Nobody was prejudiced, and that's kind of a red herring as far as I'm concerned. I wanted to say to the court very emphatically that, as a matter of fact, the facts of this case, this follows the classic pattern of dishonesty under a fidelity bond. Classic pattern. As to the law, federal courts and even state courts around the country will pay attention to the and give meaning to the adverse domination doctrine because the wrongdoers were in control of the insured entity, as here. And courts around the country will give life to that doctrine as a matter of equitable justice in labor law regulation by the federal government, mutual funds by the regulation by the federal government.
Look, I don't want to cut you off. And in fact, if anything, my colleagues think that I'm the worst on cutting them off. So, but there comes a point, and I thank you for your argument. But
is it your view that because you didn't know who the insurance company was, the time limit for filing should have been told until you did find out? Is that
not in every case, but when the wrongdoers control the insured entity?
Well, I know that's another argument.
And as a matter of logic, why would the federal courts allow it in all other cases but not ERISA, where it's clearly federal policy? Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Wall. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.